Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
In today's episode of the Sixers Beat, Rich and I go over the Sixers' 123-117 win over the Brooklyn Nets, which gives them a one-game lead over the Nets as the top seed in the Eastern Conference with 17 games left to play. But since they now have the tiebreaker thanks to a 2-1 record against the Nets, it's essentially a two-game lead. We talk about whether the Sixers should be able to hold on to that top spot, about what we saw last night and how that might translate to a potential playoff matchup between the two teams. We then pivot to how absurd it is that Joel Embiid is having the best Sixers season in 40 years, yet will probably walk away without even a first-team All-NBA or All-Defensive Team nomination. Enjoy the podcast. All right, welcome everybody. This is Derek Podner, joined by Rich Hoffman on the Sixers Beat, a part of the Athletics Podcast Network. We have a first place Philadelphia 76ers team to talk about, and that will be a... We will probably have a chance to say the first place Philadelphia 76ers for a little while now, because they won against the Brooklyn Nets 123-117 last night, which gives them not only a one-game lead with 17 left to play over the Nets for the top spot in the Eastern Conference, but also gives them the tiebreaker, the 2-1 season series tiebreaker, because they're only playing three games because it's a 7-2-game schedule. That is now clinched, so they have basically two games in hand. But how you doing, Rich?
I'm good, man. So I really had two takeaways from that game. Number one, and like you said, the Sixers now have a two-game lead, essentially, in the tiebreaker. Number one, the Sixers should get the one seed. I didn't think this was going to happen. If you listen to us at the time of Joel Embiid's injury, yep, I might have said guaranteed number three seed, or it was looking that way. I was wrong. Hand up. They have weathered the storm better than any team in the East this year. They're in the best spot. And the other reason I think that they are going to get that number one seed, because the Nets really don't seem like they give a shit.
They don't give a shit. Yep.
That was...
No, if getting the number one seed was a priority, sit their stars against Minnesota, play the Sixers with a fully healthy and lined up squad, they did not do that. So that does tell you, and look, there's a lot that we'll talk about with that game in terms of what it means. The number one takeaway is that was a huge game from the Sixers' perspective to get that number one seed. And it's not only huge because they have now essentially a two-game lead, but it's huge because it does show that Brooklyn just isn't prioritizing that. And whether or not that is disrespect to the Sixers or just a self-confidence within that clubhouse, they do not seem like they think home court advantage against the Sixers is something to really push for, which is a decision. I'm not going to say it's right or wrong. Quite frankly, it is wrong.
I think it's a little confident. Wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, they could be both confident in themselves and also get hit with a little bit of hubris there. Yeah, the Sixers should have a good chance now with, like I said, 17 games left to play.
Well, also, Coach Vibes, Hall of Famer Steve Nash. I mean, it really didn't take that much effort to, okay, fine, you want to sit Durant and play him against Minnesota? Again, that's not the decision I would have made, but I think a lot of times when you have these stars, in general, they play the first one. That's how it goes. Fine. You're making a furious comeback and can get kind of a BS win because the Sixers completely left their foot off the gas pedal. And by the way, even with this Sixers team, who I think have been better with holding leads in third and fourth quarter, it's a very fine line between closing the game and leaving Embiid on the bench. And wow, You're very lucky that Coach Vibes did not put Kyrie Irving back in the game. They were running offense through Alize Johnson, who the Bluecoats were beating in the playoffs 4 weeks ago. And Steve Nash was like, that's cool. And Kyrie Irving sitting on the bench, having played a masterful offensive game. Just, yeah, no, we're not going to play him. We're going to let the bench guys try and win it. And the bench guys are pretty good. I don't think they, like, they shouldn't have taken out all of their players. Nick Claxton certainly should have been in that closing five. I would say Bruce Brown should have been in that closing five as well. But man, like Jeff Green, Kyrie Irving, Joe Harris wasn't that good last night, but any of these options are sitting on the bench. You know, you're running it through Landry and TLC, a lot of former Sixers, you know, on that Nets team, on that Nets bench with the coaches and everything. They just don't give a shit. And so I don't think that's necessarily a huge deal for the Nets, but if you do have to play the Sixers on the road, the Sixers are a much better team when they can start in Philadelphia. Maybe the Nets' talent will just be too overwhelming, but yeah, I didn't necessarily agree with not caring that much. Like, you could give a little bit of effort to try and get that one seed.
Right. These were all, like, you could have gotten Durant rest while still having him play against the Sixers. You could have allowed some of those bench players who get an extended run because they're responsible for that comeback, while also then shuffling in your star player, who, by the way, was, like you said, having a very good offensive night. I saw a little bit of, well, actually, oh, well, look, he was a negative 13.
Single game plus minus.
Single game plus minus doesn't tell you too much until it supports our narrative, and then people love to run it out there. He was very good against Sixers, and we'll get into what that means.
You know why he had a bad plus minus, by the way? He played against Joel Embiid most of the night with DeAndre Jordan guarding him.
Right.
That's why he had a bad plus minus.
Not to hand wave some of his defensive miscues, because Kyrie is a terrible defender.
He didn't give up 80 points from Tobias Harris. Come on. I mean, look, just my thing is, don't make me defend Kyrie Irving. That's my, when you're making me defend it, like, did you watch the game? He was masterful on the offensive end. He was, that offense, I don't care if he gave up a bucket every time on the other end of the court, which he did not, and he is weak on that end of the court. Minus 13 does not do justice to how well he played.
Right. But yeah, the number one takeaway is that they have an inside track on that number one seed. So let's shift and talk about what we did notice in that game. Now, of course, we have to mention the Nets were without Kevin Durant, James Harden, LaMarcus Aldridge, which we'll get to, is a little different of a situation. Two pretty big heavy hitters there. Blake Griffin was out. So a lot of talent off of the table there. The Sixers were without future Hall of Famer and Dwight Howard as well. Not that that's quite comparable, but they
wearing
were
wearing some very loud orange pants on the bench. Dwight Howard.
Very loud. Yep. So both teams were missing some players, and that's obviously missing far more of what makes them the Nets. And now you will have gone a 3-game season series between these two teams where you got one game out of James Harden, one game out of Kyrie Irving, and no games out of Kevin Durant in those three matchups. So we really don't have a whole lot to go on when you project forward to a playoff series. That being said, we'll spend the next 20 minutes projecting forward to a potential playoff series, because right now the rest of the regular season, while the chase for the number one seed is important, that's why we let off the podcast with that, the rest of the regular season really is a tune-up now for that postseason. And we've got a couple of key matchups coming up here, not a back-to-back, not even a home and road, but a road, two-game series against the Bucks coming up here soon. But this was a big one. And I thought it was interesting a couple things. How they defended Kyrie Irving, how they attacked Kyrie Irving, and how the Nets defended Joel Embiid are probably the three things you can take the most from this lineup. And also how they defended Ben Simmons, because that came into play there as well. Where do you want to start off?
Start out with how they defended Joel and Ben, because I think that's probably the most transferable to, you know, you'll just have different people in those spots. But when the Sixers are on defense, Nets are on offense, the talent is, well, you know, the talent gap between what we've seen and what we're going to see is something that is probably going to play more of an impact there.
Okay.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service that you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So they defended him, started off the game with defending Embiid with DeAndre Jordan. Towards the end of the game, they certainly started denying more, trapping more, fronting a little bit more than they did in the beginning. Joe sort of brushed that off as a reason why they struggled down a stretch, but I think it did play a little bit to that. You know, I think first of all, it just goes without saying, you know, Joel had, 37 points through the first three quarters. Didn't even really have his A game. He was missing some of those jumpers again. Missed a couple of bunnies inside. Still got to the free throw line. You know, I think, the main takeaway is they can't defend him one-on-one. And really going back and rewatching it, when they have to rotate, they're fucking awful. Like, they are just an awful defensive team. Like, you saw, going back to Kyrie Irving, there were a couple where he meanders over in the vicinity of Joel Embiid. And he's still 3 feet away, and he's not really doubling Embiid, and he's leaving his man open. Like, he's just an aimless defender at times. And I saw that a lot last night. A couple where Joel still split the double team and he had Danny Green wide open because Kyrie Irving just didn't really commit to either. Joe Harris, God bless him, but like, Sixers are posting up Tobias Harris. They send a double team. Joe Harris just lets Ben cut right through the middle, right for a layup, and DeAndre's not going to leave his man because DeAndre's got Joel in a dunker spot. Like, their principles in terms of double teams are just awful. Sixers traditionally haven't been a very big matchup hunting team, but with Joel, they can hunt a matchup, which is pretty much anyone in the league. With Harris, they can hunt a matchup, or Simmons, they can hunt a matchup if they have Kyrie on him, and they're so bad at covering up for that is going to... Look, I don't want to go into a series where you're reliant on Tobias Harris or Ben Simmons posting up a lot, but I think the Nets might be so bad that you can get away with some of that.
Doc, from a schematic standpoint, I think one of his strengths, really good off the ball against the switching defense to get the matchup he wants, often Tobias against the smallest, weakest defender on the perimeter. And I think you can see, like, the Nets, they switch pretty much everything. When DJ is in there, they don't switch. But when Claxton is in there, and they are a better team when Claxton is in there, I don't think Claxton's going to stop Joel. We can talk about that. They switch everything. And if you're going to do that, like, Doc is pretty good at pulling the strings that Tobias gets that matchup. And Tobias, this entire year, has proven that he can score against a favorable matchup for him. I think Tobias is going to eat. Like, he was not dealing, or he was not feeling that well. He was dealing with a knee injury of some sorts. That's, I guess, something to take a look at, too. 11 of 17. I think every shot he missed, I was like, man, that was a very makeable shot. Every shot he got was pretty easy. I think the way the Sixers were attacking them is pretty easy. And they, you're right, they can't guard Joel. Like, I thought Joel, what do you think? C-plus game from him? I thought, yeah. C-plus health for the first half. He was laboring during the first half of that game. Certainly didn't have the explosion, didn't really get into it that much after the game, what he was dealing with, whether that was the knee actually bothering him or this brace that he adjusts 30,000 times per game. Whether, you know, regardless of which one it was, he didn't have the same level of explosion, and he also didn't have the same level of touch. DeAndre, who I don't think is the worst matchup just because he is big, so... It's a little harder for Joe to bully him. He's going to bully him eventually. Like, I don't want to say that he's not going to get all the way to the rim and get fouled. He was giving anything, I would say, outside of 16, 17 feet is a warm-up shot. The three for Joe, I know he's always open from three, but how many times has he gotten people with those pump fakes? No, he could, like, you could throw him the ball with 20 seconds left on the clock. He could dribble the ball for 18 seconds and then fire a three at the end, and DeAndre will not go out any closer towards him. So I am very confident that he, if he is healthy, if he is making that jump shot, he is going to torch these guys. But they do play way off, and that's Jeff Green at the beginning and then Claxton at the end. They also play laughably off Simmons to a degree that I'm surprised other teams don't take it this far. They were under the basket against him. And frankly, like, why not like dare him to make shots against you? If you have a defender as big as Claxton, stand under the rim, make him try to shoot 20, 25 shots because, you know, we saw at the end of the game, he was entering the ball to Embiid. Ben was standing behind the three-point line. His guy was already on Embiid. Like, he's not even looking at the basket. He's trying to thread an inbounds pass to Embiid. And look, that could be changed a little bit. Like, just don't make Ben the inbounds passer. Make it a little bit easier on Joe. But that is probably the most informative thing that the Sixers got from last night's game. They saw how the Nets are generally going to guard their two best players, and they are going to sell out to stop them at the rim. And, you know, I don't want to take too much from the end of that game. I do think that was a little bit of a weird, fluky fourth quarter. Doc tried to sit Embiid and Simmons for the entire fourth quarter, and for a while it looked like he was going to get there.
Yeah, they were up. They were up, what, like 15 at one point. Like, they certainly had a chance. Yeah. Yep.
And then he had to put him back in with about 4 minutes left in the game, and they had no energy. Right? Joe sat 3 minutes longer than he probably should have. I'm not taking too much from that, but just we know that's coming. We know that they're going to play off Joe, and they're really going to play off Ben, and the Sixers have to work around that. And I certainly don't think they were 100% there last night. That's okay though. But that is what they're going to see.
Yeah. No, I think, and look, that like I said, the combination of having a lot of individual defenders that you can attack, whether that's a guy like Joe, who you're used to attacking with, or even a guy like Tobias, who now might become someone that the Nets are going to double team a lot. If you get that team into rotations, I think the Sixers are going to have success picking them apart. You know, the concern does come in. Like, I do worry a little bit, especially with Claxton. If he is defending Simmons and he can be that off-ball roamer, I think he can cause a little bit of havoc. He's not a good matchup with Embiid because Embiid is just physically too strong. But with Simmons, he could cause some. And that's always going to be sort of like the rub with Ben. You give a team 7 games to figure out how to make use of his non-threat in the half court. And do they have the combination of personnel and scheme to make use of that? They will get better when Durant and Harden come back. Durant is outside of Claxton. He's our best defender. Harden is at least a guy you can't post up. So now you only have really one or two weak guys in Irving and Harris to mismatch hunt against, but you still have Irving and Harris.
So if the Nets close with Claxton at center, I mean, who's guarding Embiid then, right? Like, you can only guard one of the two. So That is one of the issues. I mean, they had Alize Johnson.
Solve one problem and you create another one, for sure.
Yeah, and to be fair to the Sixers too, like, another reason why I agree with Joel that it was a bit of a weird ending. Tobias, that he got taken out in the last 3.5 minutes because his knee was hurting him. He's your mismatch hunter. He's the guy that Doc runs those money after timeout plays for if they're not for Embiid. So, yeah, I think you don't want to take too much from it, but you did see a sketch of what Brooklyn is going to do against those guys. Nick Claxton, by the way, my favorite play of the night. He's he's obviously a very switchable five. He's, you know, he can move his feet, he can contest at the rim against Simmons, all that stuff. Gets the Corkster on a switch, might have stopped him 5 times on a drive. And Cork didn't lose the ball, but he got stoned, like, trying to make his move 5 times. Don't you dare give the Corkster a 6th drive.
Corkster, who might end up, like, he may very well have worked his way into that playoff rotation. It probably a little bit matchup dependent, but he has been playing very good basketball, really on both sides of the court the past week or two, which has been not something you can always say about him. He's playing well. So let's move on to the other side and defending Kyrie Irving. Whew, he's a tough one. The Sixers started off, they certainly trapped a little more than they normally did. They switched a little more, especially on the, you know, when it was some combination of Simmons, Harris, and Green. But they also then gave up a couple of open mid-rangers to him as well. And then some, he can just, he had a couple of, that spin move he put on Matisse. Oof. And then shielding him and getting that finish. Like, you just, you can't guard that. There's nothing you could have done to prevent that. He is going to be a problem for the Sixers. You know, I think looking at the matchup data, and I don't put too much stock in the matchup data on this one because, like I said, there was so much more trapping. There was so much more switching on pick and rolls. But I think Simmons held him to 5 points on one of two shooting. But the flip side is he had five assists and only one turnover because they were forcing the ball out of his hands. He's just, he is a very good, complete offensive player. And when, I mean, I guess we can, a couple minutes on defending Kyrie, but then we'll move into when they have their other big three available.
That move he put on Thibault was so nasty.
It was incredible.
That's really good defense, and that's the theory of the Brooklyn Nets. It's that, look, you can put out Ben Simmons and Matisse Thybulle, who are these two awesome wing defenders, and our offense is just going to beat you because that's the way the league is right now. And
and the Sixers had an entire game where they could make sure that they had, and Danny Green still defended him quite a bit, which probably more than I would have liked. But they had the option where they could have put their two best defenders on Kyrie the entire game, and he still dropped a very easy 37.
It's
a very good offensive play.
You didn't like Danny Green guarding him last night.
I think
we'll get ready for Danny June, Green, man.
Yeah, I think Danny Green gave up like 10 points in like 4 of 6 shooting in like maybe like a third of the possessions that Ben Simmons was on. It was not good.
It was a very Beal-like effort from Danny, like Beal-point effort from Danny. Yeah, it's look, that's not his strength. He's staying in front of guys. That's not where he shines. He's Covington, man. He's the off-ball defender. He's probably a little bit better at staying in front than Cove. But
he certainly was in his prime.
Yeah, no, it's tough for him now. It's I wouldn't, when you have him against Kyrie Irving, that is scary. So. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I thought Kyrie was just awesome offensively for three quarters, and the Sixers, they scored on the Nets very easily, in part because Kyrie is very bad defensively. But I mean, some of his passes, I thought he did an awesome job reading when Joel was going to help him.
Yeah,
and he threw lobs to DeAndre, who's, you know, he's obviously not Lob City DeAndre anymore, but if you put it up there for him, he could still get it and jam it. He had a couple actually on Embiid backpedaling that are kind of half posters type of.
Yeah. And I mean, that's probably why in that game you see more trapping, because you trap, you get the ball into like Jeff Green's hands. Well, Jeff Green has a pass to DeAndre. He has a pass to the corner. Jeff Green's not good enough to see either of those passes. So you can get him to sort of reset the offense and get your defense back to where it needs to be. You trap with James Harden and Kevin Durant on the floor, one of those two is going to beat you before you have a chance to recover. It gets much more dangerous.
Everything and the thing gets that you, more dangerous. The thing you can't take away from this game is that, look, when Durant, and especially when Harden is in the game, Kyrie has the ball in his hands a lot less when Harden plays. Harden is the point guard of that team. But Kyrie is having, and by the way, I say this as somebody who's not the biggest Kyrie Irving basketball fan in the world. We can, I'm not even going to comment on the other stuff, but I've thought, like, yes, he's very valuable when he has a LeBron James next to him. He can get his shot at the end of games. That is a valuable skill set against playoff half-court defenses, but in terms of, like, him raising your floor, being the main guy, he's not that good. But it doesn't matter. When they have Harden, he's playing the most efficient basketball of his career. Like, he's like a catch-and-shoot guy. He's making quick decisions off the ball. He's, man, he's a handful. And if he's their third best player, which I certainly think he is, that's tough. Have you noticed, by the way, Ben, on, I think it was on The Jump, he said it, and then he said it to us after the Dallas game. He has been hammering the hashtag there's only one ball thing with the Nets, and you know, maybe he's trying to speak it into existence, but Yeah, he's been going hard at they got to play defense and they got to share the ball. I don't know. I think they're doing a pretty good job.
It might be only one ball, but you've still got to defend all three of them. And that makes it easier on the other two. It is. Yeah.
Well, there's also only one best offense in NBA history, which they have too. So, you know, it's.
And as we have said many times, there's only one Ben Simmons. So they are going to have, we talk about matchup or mismatch hunting on one end. Like they're going to have their opportunities for sure. And with the way they can put you into ball screens, it's going to be a lot of very uncomfortable decisions when you have to guard all three of them. If that ever happens, it's amazing how little that's happened. We really have no idea what it's going to look like.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Well, and a big part of their game plan, I imagine, is they're going to want Embiid to switch at times just because they're probably supremely confident in what Durant and Harden and Irving can do against a switch. Now, to Joe's credit, after kind of limping up and down the floor for the first half, he blocked the shot from the weak side on Kyrie in the third quarter, and then he stayed in front of him on a switch, which was nice. That was kind of like old school Joe staying in front of a guy who you would think would just be able to blow by him.
I like how you're saying old school about a guy who's like 27.
Yeah, there's been a lot of stuff that's happened,
there's
you know.
Been a lot of stuff.
I think it's a fair point by you, but...
It's a fair point by you, too. It's not wrong. Yeah. I'm just pointing it out.
Old school when he was 80 times more athletic than he is now, but not as good. So, yeah, like I thought they made him work a little bit. That's going to be part of their game plan because one of the ways to slow him down is to make him work on the other end of the court and hope he's... hope he's tired, but yeah, it's going to be, look, it's going to be impossible to guard that. I just think that the story of that series is impossible to guard the Sixers on one end with that personnel.
Yeah. Yep.
Impossible to guard the Nets on the other end with that personnel. And I would imagine
with any personnel really.
Yeah. They don't even need to get switches is the tough thing. So
no, it is going to be fun to watch. I really hope it happens. I hope it happens with everyone healthy. Well, everyone, I guess, bring it up. They were, you know, we said it without Durant and Harden and Blake Griffin, also with LaMarcus Aldridge, who at the time he was listed as out with a non-COVID illness. We found out today that, as he announced himself, that he had an irregular heartbeat in his final game and that he is retiring from the NBA. So that is a, you know, I don't even really care too much about how it impacts a potential matchup. That is a very real-life health situation. All you can hope for is the best health. That is the number one priority. And what was probably a tough decision. This is his livelihood, a chance to run for another, for a title, and just brutal. Just brutal. That was a shocker and a tough one, too. It's one thing to break a foot, but so talk about a heart, that's different.
Hall of Fame player has a heavy play for a title team. Yeah, that sucks. Or I don't know if he's a Hall of Fame player, but awesome, awesome player. I actually don't.
I actually looked it up yesterday because I was making the comment about how many Hall of Famers were out of that game. In the Harden, Durant, Dwight are all pretty much no doubt about it. I think the Hall of Fame probability on Basketball Reference has Dwight at a 97% chance. And then the other two are obviously 99 or 100. I think Griffin and Aldridge were both around 50-50.
Yeah, I would believe it. I don't really. The only one that I ever get in an argument about is Chris Bosh is definitely in the Hall of Fame.
Should be. Yep.
Normal people, normies, don't always agree.
Didn't he have an irregular heartbeat too?
He did, and I bet he'd still be playing right now. He had a game that feel like he would age better. Yeah. So that sucks. You said you didn't want to talk about the how it affects them in a playoff series. I don't think it affects them all that much, because I was worried they were going to play him and Griffin more than Claxton, who is a better player, and it gives them a different element that they have now. Now they don't have to make that decision. I mean, LaMarcus is still, he's still a pretty good offensive player, but man, he would have had some trouble on the defensive end.
Yeah.
Against Embiid.
All right. So, you know, I guess we'll say, because Joel was so good the other night, do you think he has a legitimate chance for MVP now? You know, there's obviously been a couple of big developments since he went out, since we had this conversation. He only missed 10 games. The Sixers held up well. They went, what I think, 7-3 and then 10 that he missed. And then LeBron James obviously went out and is missing a significant amount of time, takes him out of the running. And then, you know, the Jamal Murray injury. If the Nuggets, right now, it seems like it is Jokic's, certainly Jokic is the strongest contender. I'd say he's probably the front runner for MVP award. But if the Nuggets now struggle without Murray, and the Nuggets fall back to fifth or sixth in the West, which is a little tougher because the Lakers aren't probably going to win too many games until AD and LeBron come back. But if the Nuggets do fall, does that open up the door for Embiid to win MVP again?
No.
Okay.
I just think, like, look, as long as the Nuggets don't fall off a cliff, which I don't think they are, not in the regular season, the Murray injury is catastrophic for them playoff-wise. But
the problem with that, so they are what they are 2.5 games, or no, they're a game up on the Lakers. Nuggets are in fourth, Lakers are in fifth, and they're a game up, but they have a 3.5 game cushion over the Blazers, and then a 4.5 game cushion over the Mavericks for 6th and 7th. So really the only team that could realistically vault above them is the Lakers, and the Lakers are playing super shorthanded as well.
Yeah, and, you know, sometimes I laugh at the justification for whether Embiid's chances have improved or not. Like, I remember Tobias saying after that 7-3 stretch, he was like, this is great. Our chances to get Joel the MVP have improved. Like, we're going to be the one seed maybe, and that's a big deal. And, I, like, on the one hand, I agree with that. On the other hand, you guys just went 7-3 without him. Like, you guys, pretty good team. Like, I this is not me in my head, like, thinking any less of Joel Embiid. It's more, you know, as somebody who's watched all of his games, hey, finally, you guys held up your end of the bargain without him. But I think to a normal voter, it's like, eh, all right, that's probably not the best thing in the world for him. He is, he's been the per minute MVP this year.
Look, he is having an MVP caliber season. I agree with you. It would take Denver to fall to fifth or sixth. I don't see that happening. And even so, like, that seems very arbitrary if they win the same amount of games.
In the West?
Yeah, but voting does tend, I mean, like, all of these voters are not going to be, think, like, voting can be arbitrary. I think there's a psychological difference between 3 and 4 versus 5 and 6, but I do think that they will weather the loss of Murray. And not, because there just aren't that many, like, the West has separated itself quite a bit, and the Lakers not being healthy, I don't see them overtaking it. Joel Embiid having an MVP caliber season, came back, has looked good here. You're in a spot for the one seed. That's all great. I think it would still be an outside chance of winning the MVP award. But I hope, look, he's had an MVP caliber season. Just, it's tough when you miss that many games.
Let's say they get the one seed and they play normal basketball kind of the rest of the way through. Nothing, you know, no explosions. Joe is relatively at his normal level. It's mostly what we've seen throughout the year. Do the Sixers win any major awards? There are two that I'm thinking of right now.
Yeah, well, Coach of the Year and Executive of the Year.
I wasn't thinking about Executive of the Year. I don't really care about that one, although I think often being an NBA GM, winning Executive of the Year is something that you've done 3 years ago to lay the groundwork for that. Like, Sam Hinkie should have been the 2017-18 Executive of the Year.
I think he got a vote the year he was pushed out, or the year he left. If you're not watching the video, I'm doing air quotes. I think he got a vote. I'd be curious to find out who that was. Yeah, but with Daryl, it's pretty interesting because a lot of their improvement can be directly attributed to the moves he made last fall. I do agree with you that a lot of times that award goes to who made the best moves years ago. I think Doc could get consideration for Coach of the Year. Do I think he's going to win it? Probably not. Although I'd have to really think down and think about who I think will win it.
Monty Williams.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, that's a shoo-in. Forget it. With the year that Phoenix is having, yeah, for sure.
But Doc could legitimately come in second. The other one I was thinking of is...
defensive.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Ben Simmons.
Really?
Well, you think Joe is going to actually get more votes than Ben?
No, I think it's going to Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, but I think Ben's going to come in second.
I feel like the narrative around that is stronger, yeah. You're probably
yeah,
right.
And that's the reason why. That was the point I'm going to bring up.
If I was voting, I would vote Joe over Ben. Which, by the way, this goes back to an article you just wrote at The Athletic on the impact of wing players, wing defenders versus big men, and whether or not it's realistic for a wing player to win a Defensive Player of the Year award. So go check that out over at theathletic.com/SixersBeat. I still think Joel has a bigger impact on defense, but I think the narrative around Ben is strong enough this year, probably made up for a couple of a little bit of being overlooked in previous years. You're probably right. He would come in second. Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think they're going to have, I think Joel is going to end up with a second team all defensive nomination, Ben a first team all defensive nomination. I think Joel is a more impactful defender, but Ben is sort of the more unique defender. And I do agree with that. The narrative is sort of on Ben's side in that regard. Yeah.
This is going to be brutal, by the way. Joe is not going to get first team all NBA or first team all defense.
Yeah.
Brutal. For this season?
Yeah.
Look, he played power forward against the Hawks in that one game where Dwight Howard played with him. That's enough. Write him in as a power forward on both teams.
Yeah, no, I hate losing stuff to positionality, for sure. But you're right. It's probably going to be Jokic's first team all NBA center and Gobert is first team all defensive center. And Joel having the best Sixers season probably since the 80s. I think it's better than Iverson's season.
Some of those Barkley seasons were pretty nasty in the late 80s, early 90s. I'm not sure it's better than Joe just because so much of Joe's impact is and has always been defense. Yeah. So. Yep. No, yeah, I think it's probably better than the Barkley seasons, but that's an accomplishment being better than those because Chuck in the late 80s, early 90s was insanely good.
And quite honestly, I would have to really think about the Moses and the Doc seasons back then too and really sit down and put them in proper context. But Joe is comparable to really just about any non-Wilt Sixers season in franchise history, and he's going to walk away with no awards for it, which is pretty incredible.
It's terrible. I mean, and there's the stat on how many free throws he's taking. That actually can be traced back to Wilt per game. When you go back that far and Wilt is always the backstop with that stuff, man, you know you are just putting in work. And yeah, this sucks. He's got to make first team All-NBA. This bullshit that he wouldn't make it.
He's not. And I say that and I don't have a vote. You don't have a vote. So we can say that and sort of remove ourselves from the process. But he is probably not. And he is. Then that's why these awards, I don't spend too much time worrying about it because they're very arbitrary. What's your competition like? How many games have you played? What are the circumstances around your team? All I know is Embiid is playing unbelievable basketball. And we get a treat to watch him every night. And he has a chance to put the Sixers in real title contention. And that's what really matters at the end of the day. Anyway, I think that's probably a good enough place to wrap it up. Thank you, Rich, for jumping on, and we'll talk to you soon.
See you, man.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic.
See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.